This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, the Summit of the Americas and U.S.-Latin American Relations. Hello again. I'm Carol Castiel. While the horrific chemical weapons attack in Syria grabs headlines, we turn our attention this week to Latin America as the next Summit of the Americas is underway in Lima, Peru. U.S. President Donald Trump was expected to attend, but abruptly canceled on Tuesday, citing the crisis in Syria as his reason for scrapping his first Latin American visit as president. Analysts say skipping the trip spared Mr. Trump potentially unpleasant interactions with leaders of Latin American nations whose citizens have been offended by his harsh language about their countries as sources of illegal immigration, criminal gangs, and illicit narcotics. Many regional observers say that he is forfeiting an important opportunity to exercise U.S. leadership in a region where China and Russia are making significant inroads. Vice President Mike Pence is attending the summit in the president's place. Well, with us to discuss the significance and potential outcomes of the Summit of the Americas in Peru and the state of U.S.-Latin American relations in general are two distinguished regional analysts who are no strangers to these VOA microphones. Eric Farnsworth is Vice President of the Council of the Americas and the Americas Society, and that's a leading voice on Western Hemisphere affairs here in Washington. And Eric Olson, he's Associate Director of the Latin American Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and that's a prominent think tank also here in Washington. And the two Erics join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, Eric Farnsworth, let me begin with you. Mr. Trump is skipping the summit ostensibly to deal with Syria. How is this decision viewed in the Southern Hemisphere?
It's being viewed, I think, in a mixed manner. Clearly, the summits of the Americas since 1994 have been a presidential-level meeting that happen every 3 or 4 years, this being the 8th Summit of the Americas, and it will be the first time that a U.S. president has not been able to attend. So I think from that perspective, the symbolism is probably unfortunate because this is an opportunity, by definition, really, to try to come together at the presidential level and make progress on some very difficult issues, whether it be the crisis in Venezuela, whether it be some trade issues, or indeed the topic that is formally on the agenda in Peru, which is the fight against corruption across Latin America and the Western Hemisphere. So from that perspective, I think that a number of folks are disappointed that the president won't be going. At another level, I think there's probably some sense that, well, we can make progress with the United States, and together, no matter who the leaders are, if we look at this from a pragmatic perspective and try to achieve the goals that the people of the region are looking for as well. So I would say that the reaction that I've seen and heard so far has been mixed.
What's your take on reaction from the region, Eric Olson?
Well, I think there are two kind of emerging narratives on the Trump administration in Latin America. One of them suggests that the best way forward with the United States is to kind of ignore what comes out of the White House, ignore the sort of the bombast that comes across in the president's tweets, and focus on the actual practical issues before the countries in Latin America. The other narrative, of course, is you ignore the president at your own risk. And so his absence from this summit is really kind of a lost opportunity. I think it's a lost opportunity for President Trump, who hasn't been to the region yet, who hasn't heard directly from people. But it's a lost opportunity for the heads of state in Latin America to have that kind of eye-to-eye, direct communication that's not being mediated by the press or Twitter, quite frankly. And I think that's what people would really like to have, that kind of person-to-person interaction with President Trump to make their case and to clarify things directly.
And perhaps even influence his view of the region perceptions.
I mean, I think in the best case scenarios, that's what we'd like to see. You know, the issue around NAFTA, people in the region have really opened up their economies, have been much more inclined towards global competition and global trade and trade with the United States. And so they would like to be able to say to the president, don't set us back in this process. Don't rip up NAFTA over some other problems that you're not happy about. And maybe these, you know, messages would get through to the president. Maybe I'm being overly optimistic, but I think that's what we'd hope for, is that kind of opportunity.
Back to you, Eric Farnsworth. some analysts have said that not only is this unfortunate that Mr. Trump couldn't go to assert U.S. leadership, but also they see this as a way to cede authority to China and Russia. What is the impact that China and Russia are having in the region, particularly in the Southern Hemisphere, and does that worry you?
Well, I would say that both Beijing and Moscow are watching very closely what's happening in Lima, Peru right now. I think that's accurate. Both countries have raised their profile in the Western Hemisphere, and they've done so through different tools that are available, through electronic means and through the media, but state-led media, also through social media. But what they're doing is they're promoting a vision, both China and Russia, that shows democracy in some ways as to be perhaps too complicated for a region that needs answers to some very difficult questions, and trying to, in some way, throw a negative light on the practice of democracy so that it is becomes, in the public mind, equivalent to the systems that we are seeing developed from a more authoritarian perspective from Russia and China. The National Endowment for Democracy calls this the use of sharp power from both of those countries, and we're seeing it in Latin America. I would quickly say this is not just a Latin America phenomenon. This is a global phenomenon, but Latin America has proven itself to be, in some ways, an open region for this type of behavior because Latin America, for the most part, is democratic. And Latin America is looking for answers to some difficult problems. And the United States, the perception is anyway, is retreating somewhat from the region. But I would also say that Latin America right now is going through a round that they do periodically in terms of elections. And we have some very important elections coming up this year in very important countries, Mexico, Brazil, Colombia, Paraguay. We've just seen elections in other countries across the region. And this provides opportunities for countries who are so inclined. And we've seen this allegations of things that have occurred in the United States along these lines from outside countries for electoral meddling, not necessarily to put in power individuals or certain candidates, but rather to call into question the actual system and the vote and to create uncertainty around people who may be elected. It's a very effective strategy. We've seen it already used, for example, in the Catalan independence referendum in Spain, where Russia, working very closely with Venezuela, was intervening in that way in a very unhelpful and negative way, and we're seeing some similar behavior across the region. Having said all of that, Carol, look, if the Latin America wants to trade with other countries of the world, they should do that. There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, China is a major trader and investor in Latin America, and there's nothing inherently wrong with that. Latin America needs investment in infrastructure and other things. Latin America needs trade partners and also imports from around the world. And so that's not a problem. The question becomes, once you have that leverage and once you have that influence, what do you actually do with it?
Turning to you, Eric Olson, notwithstanding the very understandable reason Mr. Trump gave for not going, that is dealing with the Syria crisis, do you think his decision not to travel to the region to some extent does cede leadership to China or even Russia to broaden their very nefarious roles in the region, and that can't be seen as in U.S. interests?
I would sort of distinguish between China and Russia and their inroads, let's call it, in Latin America. I think the Chinese are using their investments in Latin America, their trade relationship, to have a greater presence there that benefits them and the region as well. I think Russia's involvement in Latin America is a different sort of involvement. It's a way to poke the eye of the United States. This relationship with Venezuela, the relationship with other countries, the meddling in the elections, like Eric referred to, Mexico is about to have major elections. They're worried. They should be worried because of the evidence elsewhere. That not that Russia will back a particular candidate, like Eric said, but to disrupt. I think the Russian relationship to the region is more disruptive, more geostrategic, less about investments. Russia is actually not that big of an economy, doesn't have the kind of resources China does. So we need to distinguish those two. And I think we need, as the United States, to be the adults in the room and accept that Latin America is emerging on its own terms. And we shouldn't really be threatened by that, as long as there's a continued commitment to democratic practice and democratic governance, which is the topic of the summit itself.
Quickly before we go to a break, Eric Farnsworth, about the summit agenda, fighting corruption, maintaining democracy and the rule of law, what do you think can come of the summit?
I think Eric Olson's distinction between Russia and China and the Americas, I think, is very appropriate and very well said. And I think going forward in the context now of what we might be able to anticipate coming out of the summit, probably not a lot from a consensus-based unified document or declaration or action plan. I mean, in theory, everybody's against corruption, but when you have the United States will be at the table at the vice presidential level, but you'll also have the leader of Cuba, the leader of Nicaragua, the leader of Bolivia, and leaders from other countries around the region, it's probably unlikely they're going to agree on certain things because agreeing with each other, by definition, may be seen negatively by them. But you can make real progress on a couple important issues at the margins of the summit, namely the deteriorating situation in Venezuela, where you do have a number of leaders who will be in Lima very inclined to make progress under the auspices of the Lima Group, which includes, of course, Peru and Canada and Argentina and many hemispheric countries. The United States is not part of that, but clearly we have interests in helping to alleviate suffering in Venezuela as well, so you can make progress there. There may be some progress on NAFTA. That's a sub-regional agreement, of course. It's only Canada, the United States, and Mexico. Hopefully we'll have something to announce there. So we have to pick our fights. We have to prioritize. We have to try to make progress where we can. And I think on that basis, sure, we could look for some positive results coming out of the summit.
Eric Olson, quickly, anything to add or subtract, particularly with respect to any progress on Venezuela? A terrible tragedy.
Right. I mean, the region has been slow to want to condemn Venezuela. There's been some movement in that direction. Maybe one of the unfortunate aspects of the downfall of Pedro Pablo Kuczynski, the former president of Peru, the one who resigned just a few weeks ago, he had been a real leader in the region speaking out against Venezuela. But that aside, I think the situation in Venezuela now becomes increasingly about what happens on the outside of Venezuela as well as what's happening on the inside. People feel like there's not a lot of ways in which they can deal with Venezuela's internal democratic struggles other than denounce. But now we have a situation with over a million Venezuelans fleeing the country. We have large-scale refugee problems. Colombia, obviously, Brazil as well. But tiny Caribbean countries are now struggling with Venezuelans appearing on their shores, coming to their lands in search of an alternative. So it's becoming really a humanitarian crisis now. And I think the region may be more willing to consider joint action around a humanitarian crisis, and where they've been a little bit reluctant to intercede or intervene on democracy and human rights within Venezuela. Personally, I think that's unfortunate that they haven't been willing to do that. But now we're in a different context where the spillover, the results of internal turmoil, is really having a direct consequence in a lot of countries. And I think the U.S. needs to work with the region around those issues.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel. My guests are Eric Farnsworth. He's vice president of the Council of the Americas and the America Society. And Eric Olson, from whom you just heard. He's associate director of the Latin American program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. We're discussing the Summit of the Americas taking place in Lima, Peru, and U.S.-Latin American relations under President Donald Trump. This is a reminder that you can listen to Encounter online as a podcast. Please visit our website, voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or like us on Facebook. And as always, we love to hear from you. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener from Akure in Ondo State, Southwest Nigeria, Wale Tony Oshoro. Thanks for your email. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send an email with your feedback to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, Eric Farnsworth, and let's go forward and talk about other issues in the region dealing with the United States and Latin America. What about the illegal border crossings on our southern border with Mexico? President Trump has called up the National Guard. He sees this as a major crisis to try to prevent illegal crossings. Do you see this as a real crisis that warrants the sending of the U.S. National Guard? How fair a characterization is that?
Well, these sorts of comments and rhetoric play well domestically in the United States, but as a means to deal with the issue, it's probably counterproductive. The truth is there is no crisis at the southern border of migrants at this stage. We have seen periods of ebb and flow, and that's very true, but the net migration from Mexico is around zero at this point. Yes, people are coming across the border. Others are returning to Mexico. Where the problem is coming from primarily is Central America, because the situation on the ground there in several countries in the northern part of Central America are in a very desperate way, with out-of-control crime, gangs, drug trafficking, lack of employment in the formal economy. And you take all these things together, it's a potent cocktail, particularly for young men who are looking to do something. They really have two choices. They can join a gang or they can leave. And if they leave, where do they go? Well, they tend to try to get to the United States, where there is greater economic opportunity. So I think a lot can be done in the source countries, the sending countries of some of the migrants, to try to increase business conditions, to try to improve security, to try to strengthen democracy. This does go back a little bit to our previous conversation about Venezuela, though, because one of the things we've also seen, and Eric Olson touched on this, about some of the external implications of Venezuela's crisis, you know, there are allegations that senior levels of the Venezuelan government are involved in drug trafficking. And where do the drugs go once they leave Venezuela? Well, many of them, trying to get to the United States, transit through Central America or other democracies in the region, and drug trafficking undermines the institutions of democracy. It introduces massive corruption. It also introduces a very delicate security situation. So, you know, one of the things to do to try to help the people of Central America is to stop the flow of drugs through very difficult environment, and that means dealing in some way with the Venezuela issue too. So all these things are interlinked, but trying to send troops to the border is maybe doing things that play well from the political perspective, but not going to have, in my view, the intended effect.
Well, Eric Olson, President Obama and President Bush both sent troops to the border. What, in your view, makes this situation potentially different? Do you see a difference between what President Trump is doing and perhaps what his predecessors did? Do you also see it as potentially done more for domestic political reasons?
I mean, the fact that Presidents Obama and Bush deployed National Guard to the border also responded to domestic outcry. There was not a trigger event in the case of Bush or Obama. It was a rapidly increasing panorama of extreme violence just across the U.S. border, growing drug trafficking, and so both presidents felt compelled to send troops there. When it comes to President Trump's actions now, it does seem like there was a triggering event. And while people focus on the caravan as the rationale or the reason for, I think more from his perspective, the failure of the U.S. Congress to include $25 billion to build the wall, proposed wall from across the U.S.-Mexican border. I think he was frustrated. He was aggravated by that. The Congress is in control of the Republicans, and even Republicans refused to include the money. So it was actually a pretty strong statement from the U.S. Congress. And so I think out of his frustration there, he started speaking about this caravan. It was really about that issue more than anything else, his desire to fulfill his promise to build the wall.
And of course, caravan, let's just qualify what that was.
Right.
Quickly.
So the caravan is also something that's misunderstood. The caravan was a grouping of mostly Central Americans moving through Mexico. And the reason they group to come up together is for their own self-protection. It's not about the United States per se. It's about the fact that most migrants that are coming through Mexico are experiencing real serious problems of extortion, both from Mexican authorities and criminal organizations, abuse of all kinds. And so they group together as a self-protection mechanism. Many of them want to file for political asylum in Mexico and in the United States.
Back to you, Eric Farnsworth. This is in no way to defend illegal border crossings, but I've heard some analysts say that if there wasn't such a demand for these kinds of workers here in America, if employers didn't need these people, perhaps they wouldn't be crossing. So there's a U.S. problem as well of demand.
Well, you can't really suspend the laws of economics, and I think that's exactly right. If you want to look at this through an economic lens, it's very much an economic phenomenon. People looking for better quality of life, and there's opportunity for that in the United States. That goes to the heart, though, of not necessarily sanctioning the migrants who are trying to take advantage of that, but sanctioning businesses who are the ones who are hiring illegal labor. They're the ones who I think would be the natural targets.
We'll see if that happens. But now I'd like to turn very briefly to the status of the NAFTA negotiations, because Mr. Trump has said he wanted to scrap it and then backed off, saying, okay, we'll try to renegotiate. And you have said on these microphones before that it has its many flaws, there are shortcomings, but it's fundamentally a good agreement for all three countries, Canada, the United States, and Mexico. Where do those negotiations stand?
NAFTA's proved its worth for almost 25 years. It does need to be updated because the global economy has clearly changed since that time. And I think as an exercise of updating it, that's probably appropriate. Having said that, because of some of the demands that the United States in particular has made, which are very difficult for Mexico or Canada to accede to, the negotiations have not made a lot of progress in bridging the gaps of the most controversial items. The key problems, such as a sunset clause of renegotiation after every 5 years, or removal of some investor protections, or how you deal with certain sectors, particularly the auto sector and components there, these are very difficult negotiations. We are running into, however, a tight time frame. Mexico has elections on July 1st. The United States has midterm elections in November. And because of the nature of trade negotiations and the democratic process to review and revise and confirm through national legislatures, there is an extended period of time that has to occur. We don't know who's going to be elected in Mexico, but it could clearly be somebody who takes a different view of NAFTA, takes a different view of the United States, wants to have a different relationship. So the negotiators are really under the gun in some way to come forward in the near term, hopefully in Lima, with an agreement, at least in principle, about a path forward.
Are you optimistic, Eric Olson, about a path forward for NAFTA in this short period of time?
I really am not. I think ultimately there will be some kind of an agreement, but not in the next 2 months. So I think it's unlikely. The administration has talked out of two sides of the mouth. You know, on the one hand, people say it's imminent. We're going to have an agreement here shortly. On the other hand, the president has threatened to rip it up in the last couple of weeks. It's a little hard to know. And with the clock ticking, as Eric says, Mexico really now in the home stretch of its presidential election, I see it as a remote possibility.
Well, gentlemen, briefly as we close, speaking of elections, Brazil, which is also having elections soon, we just saw former President Lula, one of the world's most popular politicians, as former President Barack Obama characterized him. He's going to serve jail time for corruption, of which he was accused, related to the so-called Lava Jato, the car wash scandal. Do you see this as a victory for the rule of law? Or, as others have said, perhaps the courts are gutting the legitimacy of the election coming up, imprisoning Lula, who was a leading candidate.
Former president of Brazil, Fernando Henrique Cardoso, once said that Brazil is not for amateurs. And I think that is, it perfectly encapsulates exactly the issue, Carol, that you raised. The first thing I would say is this saga has not concluded. We don't know where it's going. There are still various steps to go forward that have to be played out. But having said that, no, I think that the judicial process in Brazil is working. It's clearly an independent process. This is one of the things that many observers say that across Latin America, we need more independence in the judiciaries and more ability to hold people of high stature to account for the crimes that they've been alleged to do. Obviously, there are deep and broad political implications of this. Former President Lula remains, according to some people, one of the most popular politicians in Brazil. So if he's not able to contest the elections in October later this year, that's going to have deep political implications. So short answer is we don't know where this ends up. It is a saga that's ongoing. But I do think that the judicial process in Brazil is working, however imperfectly, and people do have something to look forward to if impunity for top-level officials is reduced or ended.
Well, you get the last word, Eric Olson, on Lula going to prison.
Well, I don't have a lot more to add to what Eric said. I mean, he's right on. I think one of the things that's uncertain, he claims that he's still going to run for president. How he runs from president behind bars is a little complicated, but he has an enormous following, and his country is very divided, so it's possible he could win a presidential election from behind bars, and then we're in uncharted territory all over again. So, wow, keep an eye on Brazil, because there's a lot going on there.
We'll certainly revisit this issue in the coming months. But I'm afraid for now, that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Eric Farnsworth, Vice President of the Americas Society and Council of the Americas, and Eric Olson, Associate Director of the Latin American Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Gentlemen, thanks, gracias, as always, for your keen insights.
Thank you.
Con todo gusto.
And thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guests. Our engineer was Joe Gill. An Encounter was produced right here in Washington. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.